Hi, this is Susan Simpson with Undisclosed Podcast. We are here for day four of Anand's PCR hearing. It's Monday, a little before court starts, and we will be resuming with the cross-examination of Chad Fitzgerald, the state cell phone expert. There is a lot more to come, I suspect. Full disclosure, it has been a very long weekend. I made it here. I was not sure I'd be here on Friday. I am here. I am running on next to no sleep from a long weekend of mostly stuff not related to this case. But for those of you who keep wishing that I would talk slower, you will probably get your wish today. I'm really curious to see what this cross is going to be like today. It's going to be interesting to see what the state comes back with, because they'll come back with something. But I know Justin's been working really hard to learn the cell phone evidence, and he knows its significance, and he knows what it can and cannot show. And I think a lot more of that will come out today in court. It is the lunch break on day four of the PCR hearing. We just finished up the testimony from Agent Fitzgerald, and we've resumed the cross-examination of Dave Irwin, who was the defense expert. So we're now back to the defense case. And I guess today so far, if two words can sum it up, it is bench conference. There has been a lot of bench conferencing, which means everyone's in the front of the room. Everyone, I mean, the attorneys are all in the front of the room talking to the judge. They put the white noise machine on, so we can't hear what they're talking about usually. They were kind of yelling a bit today, so you'd hear like expert and Saul and the document. So there were probably about four or five bench conferences in all, maybe more. And probably half the time today was actually not witnesses testifying. It was us listening to the white noise machine. So Fitzgerald was amazing on cross. Well, amazing for the defense, I guess, because he said a lot of really great things, common sense, truthful things that I don't think he realized what he was acknowledging in the context of this case. For instance, to start off with, we come back and we get into that whole issue with the documents from last time. So we ended court on Friday. He's, you know, just had this issue shown to him about the helicopter situation. And it ends with him saying, "Judge, I just found something. I need to talk to you." And there's like a hurried bench conference and, you know, some tense words. People are wondering, what was that about? What did he just find? And here's the answer. When Justin handed him the set of the 217 fax records of the cell phone stuff to look at, he gave the witness the defense's copy. He did not give the witness the prosecution's copy. We do have both now, both from the MPIA and from the binders the state's put into evidence. But the copy that, you know, he had, because that's what he had, was the defense's version of the document. And the defense version is missing half of its numbers. Half the columns are cut off. So it's really hard to interpret, and it's really hard to piece together. And Fitzgerald was rightfully, like, pissed off that he was supposed to try and interpret this document when there's like no way to do it without spending a lot of time carefully matching up information and guesstimating what you're looking at. So he said a lot of great things like, "I'm offended that you would give me an incomplete document," or, "I think I just caught you in your game. I understand what you were trying to do, but I've caught you." And Justin got him to say that that's not a satisfactory document to be using. And again, the problem is, it's the only document Gutierrez had, either because she did it badly or the state did it badly. Whoever copied it didn't do it right. So him doing all of that proves that Gutierrez did not get the information she needed to do her job right, and that an expert who was given this information would have been handicapped. But it got better, because then he went on to say, Justin's asking him, would it concern you if you found out that Oronowitz, the expert for the state at trial, was only handed a copy of the phone records as he got up on the stand? And Fitzgerald, in Fitzgerald fashion, refused to answer the question about four or five times, because he never got the lesson in witness school where it's much, much better just to answer a question you're asked rather than to dance around it for as long as you possibly can. If you start doing that, the court's going to start to laugh every single time you do that, which was happening today. It wasn't even he was like being particularly evasive at times, but he would not give a response to Justin's question, and you'd hear some giggles in the courtroom. But eventually he answered and said, well, of course I'd be shocked that happened, because it wouldn't happen. He wouldn't have done that. That's never appropriate. Lots of really good language, because of course that is what happened here. And so, I mean, that's going to make for a very nice transcript. In redirect, he brought up the helicopter scenario, the Woodlawn to DuPont Tower issue. And I had been wondering how they were going to handle this, or like what claims they'd come up with to try and explain it. I did not guess, because I did not even consider this was an option to come back with. last week when Fitz was testifying, he was asked, like, what is this? Because Justin's like, and that's a problem, isn't it, agent? This causes you to pause. This throws a wrench in your analysis. So Fitzgerald says, I'd have to go back and do more research. I know that you said one station's on DuPont. I know DuPont Circle has a metro station. Sometimes the addresses in the list of tower sites, just the list of metro area, list the office for the metro, and it's not actually where the tower is. Maybe that happened here. That's the option Theory went with. He gets up there and says, so isn't it possible that this could have been Glenmont and not DuPont? That's one of the farthest out stations closest to Baltimore, and it's much closer than DuPont. And Fitzgerald, to his credit, was like, well, I said that's a possibility, but to be clear, I am not saying that happened here. And I will say this is probably Justin's biggest misstep so far that I've seen in the case. He took the bait. He gets up on Recross, and he puts a map on the screen showing how long it is to get from Woodlawn to Glenmont. But, like, that's not the battle we're fighting, because Glenmont has nothing to do with this. In my mind, that kind of validated Theer's idea here. On the tower listing we're all talking about, we're talking about cell site D125. That is Anna. And there are three columns to the right of that. And the first column has the name, like the common name of the tower. Like, it's usually like a building or an intersection. And the next column has an actual address. And here we've got D125, that's a tower. Then the common name is DuPont Circle. And then the address is 1350 Connecticut Avenue. Now, this is not talking about DuPont Circle Metro. There's nothing about a metro here. In fact, you look at the other towers with similar designations, and it's like 2700 Connecticut, 200 Connecticut. These are not metro cell sites. And also, if you've been to DC and you know DuPont Circle, you ain't putting a cell tower on the DuPont Metro. So yeah, hopefully at some point it can be clarified that this idea that when it says 1350 Connecticut Avenue, it actually means Glenmont, can be repaired. But if that's the only response that they have to explain a helicopter scenario, I think it's very, very, very clear now that there is a reason why the disclaimer says incoming calls are not reliable.
So I'm Michael Anthony Wood Jr. I am here today for court support for Rabia because I've become an activist after being a Baltimore police officer for 11 years and then speaking about the corruption within the system. We have another example of how the system picks variables of discrimination where it doesn't actually pursue justice when they don't have a victim that they think is worthy of pursuit. So it's easy for them to dismiss Adnan, who is a Muslim male, who is brown-skinned, on whether he's having justice fulfilled for them because they don't see him as one of them. And it's a microcosm of a problem that we have policing that we think is new. But Adnan's case shows that this is a long case and a long history of not pursuing the people we see as thems and not pursuing justice for those people. And this goes over into Hay as well, because where you have Haman Lee, who is the victim in this case, but she also has these variables of discrimination in America where she is female and Asian. We don't, in America policing, want to care so much that she gets justice. What happens in policing that you see through the system evolving around Adnan, where you have the poor representation, you have the bail system, you have reliance on evidence that's all circumstantial, you have ineptitude in the detective work where they're covering up things and taking easier paths and not actually seeking justice. So we have these variables of discrimination in America that are expressed through this case where you have nobody actually pursuing justice for the victim, and then you have an easy narrative built around who we want to easily see as a suspect, as a them. And what this hopefully does for the world is now through Serial and through Undisclosed and through Truth and Justice, we've become to see Adnan as one of us, because now we hear his stories, we hear his friends, and we understand that he's somebody that's just another one of our brothers, another one of our human beings on this planet. So now that we have that personified and we can empathize with Adnan's plight, then we can also need to twist that to show how the rest of the criminal justice system we need to also be fighting for, because we have these other victims now that we see that are easy to dismiss in the typical media narrative. You have Tamir Rice and you have Rekia Boyd and you have these names that end up becoming hashtags for justice because of this very same system that I hope we can see how it's discriminated against a nod and translate to how that discriminates against a ton of minorities in this community.
So, we are, as usual, outside Dunkin' Donuts, and we're at the end of day 4 of the PCR hearing, and today was kind of a weird day. It was the most boring day by far, mostly because of the sheer amount of bench conferences going on, because I think half the day wasn't witnesses. It was all the attorneys up at the bench arguing very, very enthusiastically about various things. After Fitzgerald had his cross and direct, the cross resumed for David Irwin, who was the expert attorney hired by the defense to talk about sort of attorney standard of care and like what is and is not okay for an attorney to do in terms of representing a client. He was the one who spoke about Asia McClain and whether or not Gutierrez had a duty of care to actually investigate the alibi witness that she was. And his answer was yes, absolutely yes. I think his quote was, as far as alibi witnesses go, she was a diamond. Maybe back then she was a diamond in the rough, but still a diamond. I mean, the whole theorist's whole argument that, yeah, she's credible now, but wouldn't have been credible at 17, yeah, I'm not going to buy that one at all, because to the extent that is true, which it is a little bit true for sure, when she was 17, these memories were less than a year old. These memories are now much, much older. So she would have been much more credible, I think, just from the fact that she could credibly remember stuff. Whereas now, and she was very clear on this, there were times she had to guess. So Firu, I was, you know, it was a pretty good cross, I thought. Irwin fell a bit into the Fitzgerald trap, I felt, where he was getting a bit snippy. To be honest, you could kind of sense some animosity, which isn't good, because you want your expert witnesses to be very academic, very fact-based. The Firu definitely was effective in drawing out Irwin and getting him to make it a little more personal than generic, which I think was not a benefit to the defense's case. First line is him saying, I can't imagine, I thought that this was what my retirement job would be. Because he's been waiting out in the hallway for, like, I think 4 days now. And he finally got to go. But again, Irwin was very firm in his opinions. And he gave his, like, once he got away from sniping at Thiru, he's a very experienced attorney with a great record. And he knows his stuff, which came across loud and clear. So, and he just said over and over again, like, you're trying to get me give an answer about strategy and whether or not Gutierrez had a strategy in not contacting Asia. But there's no strategy without information. Strategy is what you make and decide upon after obtaining information and evaluating it and figuring out the best course of action. And there's no evidence of any kind of strategy here. She just didn't do it. So Thiru ran through a long, long list of hypotheticals that were contradictory in nature. In the course of these 4 days, there have been a number of theories that the states try to present as to why Gutierrez never contacted Asia, or whether she did, in fact, actually contact her or something. He has a theory that Anand actually put up Asia as a false alibi witness and manufactured her letters. That's the basis of their theory, that Anand somehow contacted Asia and asked her to type up a letter establishing some kind of alibi, and it was based on details only learned later in March, which has no evidence for it. He was doing this thing earlier. It's like, compare Asia's letters to the affidavit in support of search warrants, and you can see where the source is. Those things have one fact in common, and that's that she was buried in Lincoln Park. And I'm pretty sure that was kind of the fact that was in every single report ever on this thing. So that's, yeah. Anyway, that's where this whole story of Anand soliciting a false alibi came from. He also goes to the theory that Anand told his attorney a different alibi entirely. So we got two things there. First, we got like, oh, Gutierrez didn't contact Asia because she knew it was a fake alibi witness that her client was giving her to investigate as obstruction of justice. And the other theory is that, oh, Gutierrez didn't investigate Asia because her client was giving her a different alibi entirely that seemed more promising, so she never investigated Asia because her client didn't tell her it was important enough. There's also the theory that Rabia destroyed the files and took out references showing that references that show that Gutierrez did in fact talk to Asia, which, you know, I can disprove that one because in order to do what the state was suggesting Rabia might have done, which is take out any interview notes or any record of Gutierrez's contact with Asia, Rabia would have had known the files a lot better than she did. But, you know, that's not really evidence, just personal experience. So, you know, the state might consider that, but there's no evidence of it other than Theroux's suggestions. And then there's the gossipy witness theory, the theory that if you have a witness that you know is a very gossipy person, you might strategically decide not to talk to them, because if you do, they might gossip about it, and that would hurt your case somehow. And they were more like that. Like, there's all kinds of reasons, all kinds of hypotheticals as to why Gutierrez might not have talked to this alibi witness. So I'm sure there were more. That's all I can remember right now. Anyway, much to my surprise, it turns out Officer, a.k.a. Officer S, well, Officer Steve, did testify. I was under the impression he would only be submitting an affidavit to the court, but they actually brought him in to testify today. And he was, I mean, I found him pretty credible in terms of, like, I mean, he wasn't really bullshitting anyone. He's just like, okay, some people showed up last week at my work and wanted to talk to me and ask me about things that happened a very long time ago. And he kind of remembered stuff, but, like, he was pretty clear, like, oh, well, so also right now, keep in mind, I'm talking before I've actually seen these two notes that were taken during his two interviews. In the notes, there is an invoice from Anand's defense investigator, which says everything he did, all the miles he drove, and all the hours he worked on it, basically like to substantiate his claim for payment. And one of the entries from March, I forget the date, but it's early-ish March, says, talk to Wackenhut officer Steve. And Wackenhut was his employer, like the agency that did all this. And the prosecution found this in the defense file, which they were given. And I'm going to segue for a moment to note that if anyone saw Firu's assertions yesterday in the news about how this claim of ineffectiveness is not consistent with what we're finding in the files, I mean, put up or shut up, because clearly there's nothing in those files worth showing if all you've given us is some very misleading and out-of-context stuff that I don't think anyone actually really buys your theory of once they see the whole doc. Back to the topic at hand. Talking about how they found the file with the invoice from Drew Davis, and they see his name. So last week, or 2 weeks, I don't even know, 31st, whenever that was, feels like a lifetime, they go talk to him, and it's Theroux, a detective, and they took some notes, which I did. They were introduced into evidence, but not put it on the screen, so I have no idea what they said. And I'm still really kind of confused about what happened because it was not being explained in court. But it's, what I do know is that both these times, the detectives were writing down notes of the conversation, and then at the very end, they had officer review them and sign his name at the very bottom. And apparently, here's what the notes said. Something like, Officer Steve says there were no cameras at the library in January of 99. Officer Steve is absolutely certain Anand Syed was not in the library on January 13th, 1999. It may have said more, but it didn't come out. It was the strangest direct examination I've ever seen. Like, PCR, trial, anywhere. The notes we took, the police took of your conversation say there were no libraries, says that there were no cameras in the library. Is that the case? He said, oh, yeah, I don't remember any cameras, but it's possible there were cameras. And Theroux was like, I don't know if he had a question or if he just moved on. So, like, when it's like, oh, it's possible there are cameras. I don't remember any, but they could have been there. This goes back to the Asia thing, because on Asia's cross-examination, Theroux kept saying, well, would it surprise you to learn there were no cameras in the library in January 99? So your story of calling someone at the library and having them tell you there were cameras is false? And this was his evidence that it was false, but no, it's not false. So that was the direct, and there's one line on direct that I thought was fascinating. And I think to me it says, Steve has no idea what case this was exactly. He just had people show up at his office and be like, remember something you did 17 years ago? And he's like, not really, kind of, sort of, which, you know, is an honest response for something like this. But there was a line where it said, at some point during this interview with the detectives, they showed you photos of kids. And at some point you saw a photo of the kid that was charged with the murder? Answer, yes. Question, did you recognize him? Answer, could not remember. Question, if you had recognized him, what would you have done? Answer, call 911. The best I got to explain that is that Officer Steve's under the impression that whatever happened back then, I think he thinks the reason everyone's all interested in this, or why anyone cares, is that a killer was in the library sometime in January 99, and they want to know if he saw the killer. And I don't think, I'm not sure he's even aware the killer was a student there. This is just me guessing, but I think it's not that, I mean, Steve seems very credible. There's nothing about him that seems like he's like, I mean, even like attention seeking or like lying or just like he's being asked some really bizarre questions from a long time ago. And I don't think he was ever, I don't think anyone ever explained to him what exactly they wanted to know. And he's making a logical guess. If you're asking a security guard, if you saw someone in the library and it's a murder case, they probably want to know if you saw the killer. So I don't know. That's just me guessing. That was a really strange day in court. Anyway, on cross, I thought Chris did a great job of hitting a point that was related but different. And he says, okay, so these notes that these cops took, it says there are no cameras in the library. Did you say that? He said, yeah. But you're saying now that there might have been, you just wouldn't know. And he's like, yeah, but the cops, the cops didn't ask him that, so he didn't offer it, and so it's not in the notes. And so Chris is like, are you saying that police notes jotted down randomly in an interview might give misleading impressions about what was actually said? And I think Steve said, yeah, that'd be fair. Point being that those Juwan notes that were taken 17 years ago and are very, patchy and barely there, and Theo was using them to say that Anand solicited a false alibi from Juwan. So anyone who didn't know that would have no idea what was going on with it. Well, no, wait, there's more to it, too, because I want to know what was going on with that. How could I'm kind of speechless. The state thought it was a good idea to go find this witness, a security guard, and say, did you see this person in this photo at the library 17 years ago, on January 13th, 1999? And write down, he is absolutely certain that Anand Syed was not in the library on January 13th, 1999. That's absurd. At one point, Chris asked Steve, that's a ridiculous question, isn't it? And Steve responded something like, well, I'm not going to answer that one. Implying that, yes, it was a ridiculous question. Did someone in the state actually think, here is a great idea. Let's go find a random security guard and have him identify the fact that 17 years ago, on a very specific day that has no other importance, this one person out of hundreds of kids was not there. Wait, what? Who even thought that was a good idea? No one thinks that's a good idea. Is there some really crafty strategy I'm not seeing? Is this thing over my head somehow and I'm just missing out? I don't know. I can't take it at face value because it makes no sense, but I don't see what else could be going on. So that was Steve, and he, was just a normal guy giving a very normal statement under very confusing circumstances. Then we have, Justin says, we have a few pieces of evidence we want to get in. The first one being the Attorney Grievance Commission reports of Christina Gutierrez. And state objects, court sustains. Well, they argue first, and the state's like, none of these are relevant. It's not relevant because it's more prejudicial. It just makes her look bad. It has no bearing on these proceedings. And Justin gives very good reasons why, namely the fact that the state just spent 4 days explaining in detail over and over again how amazing and competent she was. Prejudicial means it's more harmful than useful. It's so likely to inflame the decision maker, or so likely to distract with lurid details that it's not. It's too dangerous as evidence to use. And Justin's like, we would not be doing this if her family did not give us permission to do it. They're trying to embarrass her memory. Her family says, do this. Whatever many years ago when this first came up, he ruled it was not admissible. And there is, as far as I can see, no reason that was presented that would change his mind on that issue. That was his decision then, and it's his decision now, right or wrong, and he stood by it, which, it is prejudicial. I mean, all evidence is to some extent. I mean, it's always prejudicial for one side, otherwise it's not evidence. What he did was let Justin enter it he let him identify it, but not admit it. So this way, it's in the record. An appeals court can consider it if they deem it worthy of consideration. I think they absolutely should, because right now we have an absurd position where the state is allowed to argue that there are 1,001 reasons why Cristina Gutierrez could have strategically decided not to talk to Asia or not to use her or not to do anything about it. And this, the Anand's whole theory of the case is like, okay, backing way back up. The very start, Justin said, when we met with you a couple weeks ago, you said you had one question for us. Why? Why did Gutierrez not contact Asia? And Justin said, I'm trying to answer that, Judge. The why is that she was overwhelmed, ill, failing as an attorney, and incompetent. That is their theory of the case. That is their argument. The court wants a reason, and their reason is what we've all seen from the records, is that she, as an attorney, was falling apart. We heard it from many witnesses. We heard it from, like, at least three people who knew her and saw the decline, and we see it in the files. Right now, though, as it stands, the defense is left in a position where it cannot offer evidence to explain why Asia was not contacted if that evidence involves Gutierrez being ineffective. Which sucks, that's the whole point. He has to prove she was ineffective, but he's not allowed to offer evidence of why she was ineffective. So, like, basically, I mean, it's kind of where we're at now is that the defense cannot offer its own evidence to support its theory. Instead, it must disprove every single prosecution theory of why Gutierrez didn't contact her for valid reasons. Which, I mean, that's a hard, like, how do you defeat 1,000 hypotheticals? There could be a million valid reasons. None of them really have evidence. Like, there's not evidence for it. Theory asking wouldn't surprise you isn't evidence, but unless Justin can defeat all those hypotheticals, I mean, it's victory by absence of evidence. If they can rule out every explanation but one, then fine, they win. But they can't offer their own evidence to prove that explanation. And then Justin said, the defense rests. And the judge looks at Thiru, and he stands up and says, the state rests. And there's been a couple times in these hearings when I've been like trying to write as much down as I can, and I'll think I'll hear something. I'll start to write, I'm like, wait, what? I could not have heard what I just thought I heard. And this was one of those. I was like, wait, no. As I'm writing down this, the state rests. I'm like, wait, what? Nope, the state rests. That was it. Which part of me, and this is like the conspiracy part of me, not conspiracy, sorry. And this is like the paranoid attorney part of me, is like, oh shit, that was a brilliant strategic choice. Because, I mean, let's just say there is some evidence I was really looking forward to having come in. And I don't think it can come in now. I mean, not all of it, some can. But like, I have no, like on rebuttal, there's nothing to rebut other than a few things. So, I mean, if Thiru was like trying to prevent us from getting certain stuff in, well, he succeeded. So this one goes to you, sir. But I don't know if that's the reason. I don't know what else to make of it. Cause that's it. They have one witness and that was Chad Fitzgerald and they rested. Luckily, it was the very end of the day, and there was not enough time to give closing arguments, because the defense does have rebuttal witnesses. They're just not here today because Justin didn't expect for them to be needed today. I guess, I don't know if he thought the state was putting on evidence or what, but now we'll be back here tomorrow. We are apparently expecting snow tomorrow, which I only learned the very end of the day, and I don't think it's too much, but it doesn't take too much to shut everything down around here. So, snow, stay away. We got enough, like, last week, so we're not ending things, and there'll be time tomorrow for the defense to put on a rebuttal and then closing arguments, and we're done.
Hi, this is Colin Miller down in South Carolina. I'm reporting at about 4:30 p.m. on day 4 of the reopened PCR proceedings in the Adnan Syed case. Today we had three witnesses. Two of them were continuations from Friday. The first of them was FBI Special Agent Chad Fitzgerald. At the end of the proceedings on Friday, Adnan's attorney, Justin Brown, showed Agent Fitzgerald a document which indicated there were successive pings from Adnan's cell phone in DuPont Circle in D.C. and then in Baltimore, Maryland. And the claim was it was physically impossible for a person to travel between those two locations in the time elapsed. After looking at those documents, Fitzgerald asked the judge for a recess. He granted it. And this morning, we had the continuation. According to Justin Fenton in a tweet, but now agent says doc handed to him was manipulated, and defense counters that means Syed's original defense had bad records. Seems like a great argument by the defense, because the claim is what we showed Fitzgerald is the same thing the state turned over to the defense back in 1999. And the Brady claim by the defense is the documents were manipulated. They were cobbled together from various documents, they were confusing, and they failed to key both the expert at trial and Christina Gutierrez that there were real problems with the pings in this case. And the key precedent here is Ware versus State. It's a Court of Appeals of Maryland case. It says, if the failure to make any response is rarely excusable, then certainly a misleading response is seldom, if ever, excusable as well, and that's under the Brady Doctrine. So basically, according to Fitzgerald himself, this is a confusing, misleading document, and if he's correct, that supports the defense's claim of a Brady violation. Moving to the next witness, also a continuation, this was David Irwin. He is a criminal defense attorney in Maryland, a former prosecutor. He is the one who said on Friday that Christina Gutierrez fell well below the standard for effective assistance by failing to contact Asia McClain. Basically, as far as I can tell, the deputy attorney general during cross-examination today asked a series of hypotheticals such as, would you have to contact a prospective alibi witness if they had five prior convictions? Would you have to contact them if they were on a space station? And for me, really, the question here is simple. Is there any legitimate, reasonable scenario under which the defense did not have to contact Asia McClain? And legal precedent seems to indicate the answer is a clear no. The key case here is the Griffin case. It's out of the Fourth Circuit. It's actually a case that originated from the Baltimore City Circuit Court, the same court that heard Adnan's trial and is now hearing his PCR appeal. And in the Griffin case, Donald Griffin was charged with robbery and using a handgun during a crime of violence at a Rite Aid. And basically, in the case, he claimed that defense counsel was ineffective based upon failing to contact an alibi witness, Rodney Staples. The legal precedent the court cited was Grooms versus Solem. It's an Eighth Circuit case that's been cited by a lot of courts across the country. That stands for the proposition that once a defendant tells an attorney about a prospective alibi witness, quote, it is unreasonable not to make some effort to contact alibi witnesses to ascertain whether their testimony would aid the defense. Now, in that case, the state's claim was, well, there was a legitimate reason not to contact this alibi witness. And what was that? One of the security guards at the Rite Aid actually picked the alibi witness's picture out of a photo array as one of the perpetrators of the crime. And so basically the state's claim was there was a legitimate reason not to contact this alibi witness because he could have been implicated in the crime. Fourth Circuit very quickly put aside this argument. They said, quote, this reasoning is thoroughly disingenuous. David did not even talk to Staples, let alone make some strategic decision not to call him. And then reading a bit down in the opinion, quote, the illogic of this approach is pellucidly depicted by this case, where the attorney's incompetent performance deprived him of the opportunity to even make a tactical decision about putting Staples on the stand. It's the exact same thing being argued in this case. Whatever doubts Gutierrez might have had about Asia McClain, however well-founded or ill-founded, the only way she could reasonably decide not to call her as an alibi witness at trial was by first contacting her, having someone on her team suss out exactly how reliable or unreliable she was. It seems to me from tweets that the other strategy by the deputy attorney general is to try to claim it was reasonable not to contact Asia McClain because she would have contradicted Adnan's usual routine of school track mosque. Sounds a bit to me like the Jersey Shore gym tan laundry. Problem for the state is, actually, that's not his routine, or at least it's not the routine as described in the notes by Christina Gutierrez. So I'm reading here directly from the notes of Gutierrez when Asia came up, and the notes say, Asia and boyfriend saw him in library 2:15 to 3:15, and then underlined, it says, went to library often. So Gutierrez's own notes indicate that Adnan told her he went to the library often. And beyond that, we have the affidavit from Krista, we have the testimony from Asia. both said the Woodlawn Public Library was considered part of this school, so it wouldn't even be contradictory. But beyond that, yeah, we have from the notes directly when Asia McLean is discussed, Adnan saying he went to the library often, so I'm not sure where the state is getting the claim that this was not part of his typical routine. Okay, the final witness called today, at least as of 4:30, was Steve, the security guard at the library, and basically, very briefly, he testified on direct. He didn't think the library had security cameras back in 1999, and then on cross-examination, apparently he said he's not sure whether, in fact, the library had security cameras back in 1999. This relates to Asia McLean's claim in her letter, March 1st, 1999, that she called the library and, in fact, determined that they had security cameras, which could have been used potentially to establish their interaction at the library. So, yeah, basically this witness wasn't very helpful. He waffled. And what we know is the librarian has already been called by the defense. It's the same librarian who talked to Sarah Koenig in the first episode of Serial, and what she said was back in 1999, the library did have security cameras, and in fact, she was the one who took out the tape for the security camera each day and put in the new one. So overall, it seems like a pretty positive day for the defense. We'll see if there's any more testimony today. We'll see how things shape up, but as of today, it seems pretty strong arguments on both the Asia claim and the cell tower claim. The state still has most of its witnesses to come. We'll see what comes with day five.
Hi, my name is Amber Khan. I've been following the podcast from Serial to Undisclosed to Truth and Justice. I'm from Baltimore City. I've been following the case because I was a part of the community and I heard about it growing up, and I didn't actually know the facts until I started listening to the podcast and learning more about the case. And so I'm basically here because I'm completely convinced of Adnan's innocence based off of everything that's been presented and off of everything that it seems that the state has done that's schemey and everything like that. So I have been following it from the beginning, and it only made sense to come through to the trial, to the hearing, and see what is actually going on and see everything through the end because it's important. So some of the things I think that about today is that I think that bringing in the officer was actually more harmful for the case for the state versus actually helpful, because it only proved that the state was only trying to further agenda in the schemey way that they do by having them say some things and signing off on it and getting people confused in certain situations and allowing them to continue. So I think that overall, the Adnan's defense team did a great job. I took off work on Friday and I took off work this morning. If it continues, I'm going to continue to have to take off of school and work. I took little breaks to go to school, but I was here in the beginning and end for the most part.
And it was cool today. I got to talk to a lot more fans than I have. And I have been basically rushing for 15 minutes a day, and then in the courtroom for hours, get out, 15 minutes, rush around, record four things, back in the court and sit for hours. So I haven't really gotten a chance to talk to too many people, but today I've had more people, more listeners come up, which is great. Get to chat with them briefly, as again, I'm usually wolfing down donuts or something. So that's been good. We've even gotten to talk to a few on the podcast, and if you see us about, come say hi. I love to talk to y'all. Although I may rush off suddenly when something happens, but I'd love to say hi to you guys.
Wait, is the PCR over?
No, it's not over.
Shit, what do you mean? I thought it's over. They both rested.
They rested their cases. They're still rebuttal and closing. So what? I guess we'll do the case portion.
So I am still,
yeah, you're still
sequestered. Well,
your sequestering will never end.
Bye. Hi guys, this is Rabia, and I am here at Adnan's day four of the hearing. We're doing our undisclosed live updates, or daily updates of what happens in the appeal hearing. And today has been, I've heard, an interesting, very lively day with an officer who was presented as a state's witness, who ended up doing really great things for the defense. And then I think in the morning they had more of our expert criminal defense attorney witness, Irwin, who, as everybody knows, is fantastic anyways. So both sides have rested, and I didn't know exactly what that meant. I thought that meant the case is over, they give closings, I'm not sequestered, hallelujah, but I'm still sequestered, damn it.
You've been listening to Undisclosed Live, and with any luck, we'll see you tomorrow for the very last day of Anand's PCR hearing.